Good evening and welcome to City Vision, celebrating its 20th year on local public radio, KLW. I'm your host, Joseph Pache. San Franciscans go to the polls tomorrow to elect a new mayor, district attorney, and sheriff, and to decide the fate of 8 local ballot measures. This hour, our expert panel will dissect the candidates' positions, explore the pros and cons of the propositions, and attempt to answer your lingering questions about pension reform, ranked choice voting, our city's new campaign finance rules, and any other election issue you'd care to talk about. What do you think are our city's most pressing challenges, and which candidates are best equipped to rise to those challenges? Which ballot initiatives will earn your yes vote? Are you, among others, confused about how to use the ranked choice voting system? And how will you decide whether you're going to go to the ballot tomorrow or not, or have you already voted? Lots of people are saying that there's a sizable portion of the electorate that might actually sit out tomorrow's election. Are you going to sit out, or are you going to vote? And if you're going to vote, how are you going to vote? Tonight is your chance to let us know and to ask questions about the ballot that faces you at this time. So I'm going to welcome our guests at this point. Corey Cook. He's been here many times before on these election eves. I welcome you back.
Thank you.
He's assistant professor of politics at the University of San Francisco, and he's also the director of the university's Leo T. McCarthy Center for Public Service and the Common Good. And we also are joined by Alex Clemens. He's a newbie to this show.
Good evening.
And he's a political strategist and founder of Barbary Coast Consulting, a San Francisco-based public affairs firm. He's also a lecturer affiliated with the University of San Francisco's McCarthy Center. And I asked both of our guests tonight if they had any conflict of interest in being on tonight's show, and they both said they don't have any connections to any of the campaigns that are running for tomorrow's vote. And I want to welcome you, our listeners, to join our conversation. We're going to open our phones right now so you can join us with your questions and comments. 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. If you have a question about the mayoral race, about the sheriff's race, about district attorney, or about any of the 8 local ballot measures, 415-841-4134 is the number to call to join our conversation. So, Alex Clemens, welcome to City Visions. I wanted to start with you. So, how is tomorrow's election different from other elections that we've had recently?
It's different in a number of ways. And before I get into that, I just want to say, you said that neither Corey nor I have any connections to any of the candidates, and that's not precisely correct. We're both at a point in our lives where I think we know 8 or 9 of the candidates pretty well. Neither of us, however, are working for any of them, just in case your audience is wondering.
I appreciate that. Thanks a lot.
But we have a rather spectacular race, and it's different for 3 or 4 primary reasons. Let me try to hit 3 of them. One, not in recent history and not in my lifetime have this many serious, real, formerly elected, currently elected heavy hitters in San Francisco politics all aimed for the same brass ring. One person's going to wind up being elected mayor, and about 9 or 10 serious, real candidates who are credible, who have won citywide or district elected office, are going to lose. And that's not usually how it goes in San Francisco. That's one facet that's interesting. Another one is clearly ranked choice voting. This is the first competitive mayor's race. We've had one mayor's race, but it was a runaway. Gavin Newsom won with 70%+ of the vote. It's the first competitive mayor's race that uses ranked choice voting. And while ranked choice voting can be called confusing and can be called complex, some people may be describing it thusly for political gain. I have a feeling that tomorrow or the next day, a member of the Board of Supervisors is going to move to repeal ranked choice voting, and so it'll probably be before the voters in the next election cycle. And the third thing that's primarily interesting to me is the fact that we have public financing of the major races in San Francisco. If a candidate for office is successful in raising a couple $100,000 in small increments from San Franciscans, the city then starts writing checks. As they raise more money, the city writes more checks. And all you have to do is agree, as a candidate for mayor, for instance, that you will not exceed $1.475 million in total expenditures for this race. And the city will write you 2/3 of that money, more or less. All of those 3 things have combined to make this a fascinating, interesting, vitriolic, muddy, complicated mayor's race. And I feel slightly bad for the folks who are running for DA and the folks who are running for sheriff, because all of the light and heat seems to be surrounding the fight for room 200 at City Hall.
What do you want to add to that, Corey?
Yeah, I agree with all of that. I think all I would add is that the outcome is likely to be historic, that it's likely that whoever wins tomorrow will be the first, either the first Chinese-American elected or the first Latino elected or the first openly gay candidate elected mayor. So I think tomorrow is likely to be an historic election. Turnout is obviously of critical importance. But I guess the thing that fascinates me in leading off of Alex's first point is that I really see this as sort of three distinct elections. This started out as an open seat race with Mayor Ed Lee saying he wasn't going to seek re-election, and these candidates got in the field and sort of, you know, contested the office, bumped into each other a little bit for about a year. As a pretty interesting open seat election where people thought, you know, someone could get 12% of the vote and win. Then Mayor Ed Lee, the second race was then, you know, the re-election was on, and Ed Lee got in the race. And I think by most estimations, the race became about Ed Lee, whether you liked him or disliked him. That's sort of how the race is framed, with the other candidates sort of trying to figure out how to jockey for position and what that meant and trying to sort of figure out what's going on. And the last month or so, where you see candidates who have effectively dropped off the face of the earth. Others have had enormous momentum in the last couple of weeks, and everybody's just beating the heck out of each other. And so I think, you know, you could almost chart this as three distinct mayoral elections in one.
Hmm. Alex?
It's fascinating also to realize that the term zombie candidate has come up. As Corey said, some of the candidates who are polling at, you know, more or less 0% in the polls with a margin of error of 0% are staying in the race. And in any other race in the United States of America, unless this was a pure ego trip, they'd get out. They'd endorse somebody else, but they can't. Because of public financing, they would be required, if they dropped out of the race, to repay the city the amount of money that they took in public financing. And in almost all cases, that money spent on consultants, on mail, on what have you. So they're grinning. They're putting a brave face on it. They're going out to bus stops. And I think they're telling their spouses, yeah, we're probably not going to win this one, but we've got to stick it out.
So to go to one of your last points there, Corey, about turnout or key points, which is turnout and how that's going to affect the election tomorrow. You know, Alex, you said it's muddy, it's complicated, it's vitriolic, all those things. And yet there is this sense that maybe not the entire electorate is not necessarily biting their nails trying to figure this one out or getting ready to line up at the polls tomorrow morning. Is that your sense?
Yeah, it's still hard to estimate what turnout will be tomorrow. I think most people estimate that it'll be pretty low by comparison to the mayoral elections in San Francisco. You know, we did a survey about a month ago, the USF did with the Bay Citizen, that looked at the amount of interest people were paying in the race. And it was a little disappointing, actually, to see an election that was a year old. You know, USF hosted a mayoral forum. I know the candidates were doing, I don't know, 6-7 of these a night, it seems like, all over the city. And to see the general disinterest, the high-end decideds in the race, and folks who, you know, hadn't been paying much attention to the race was a little bit surprising. You know, there was a report that came out just today showing that the turnout in Chinatown with absentee ballots is going to be high. That's interesting. I think historically, progressives have done very well as we get closer to Election Day, and have seen a bump typically as we get closer to Election Day. So it'll be really interesting tomorrow to see if you know, the more progressive parts of the city, the Mission or other neighborhoods, if you see this increase in turnout and activism around the election. But you know, it's sort of as disappointing to me that the lack of, you know, just people hanging on the streets, the signs and things like that. It seems like for the depth of the candidate pool, and I agree with Alex, there's some really amazing candidates in this field. I joke, I live in Oakland. I would take all of them, actually.
On a rotating thing, sort of Tuesday, it's Phil Ting as mayor, and Wednesday, it's Mikhail Alioto Pierre.
We had a mayor once that just came in on Tuesday, so I think we could probably work that out. But I think this is a really deep pool of candidates, and so I think it's a little bit disappointing that we haven't seen the citizenry is activated and engaged. I think part of that is a result of the financing system. Part of that is a result of, you know, San Francisco has a pretty narrow political ideology, and you stick 12 candidates who are all eminently qualified in that mix. And I think to a lot of voters, it just appears like a lot of just, you know, minor degrees of difference between the candidates. And so it's difficult to discern what the key issues are, who the differences are between the candidates. And I think...
And they'd be satisfied with whoever was in the office,
you're
saying?
I think as a result, voters are just sort of view this election as, you know, just sort of a lot of noise and not a lot of differentiation.
I've got to say, for San Francisco voters who are relatively politically sophisticated compared to the average across the country, you can see a difference between, say, John Avalos and Tony Hall, who represent perhaps the polls on this election from left to right. in, say, Illinois, both of them would be burned as witches. So, again, San Francisco's politics has to be understood through a San Francisco prism, mm-hmm. or else it makes no sense whatsoever.
Okay. And it still made no sense whatsoever, even south.
Frequently, on Tuesdays.
Okay. So 415-841-4134. Again, we're opening our phone lines earlier this evening than usual to talk about tomorrow's elections with our guests Corey Cook here for the University of San Francisco and Alex Clemens of Barbary Coast Consulting. 415-841-4134. And it looks like we're getting some emails coming in. We can also, we also invite you to join our show through our Facebook page. Just type in City Visions and you should be able to post something there. So while we're loading up our emails, let's go ahead and get into the mayor's race. So the poll that you referred to earlier, Corey, that was sometime in October, showed that Ed Lee had 45% of the vote at that point. Dennis Herrera about 20%.
I think 45 might be a little bit.
Yeah,
high,
he was about around 30, I think.
30%. Okay,
yeah.
Okay. Sorry. So where is he? Where is he today? There's no new polling, right?
No, and actually, I should say part of the reason we did the poll so far out. Oftentimes, you would have a public poll like this. It's oftentimes a little bit closer to the election day. Uh-huh. You know, we sought intentionally to do it sort of before the real campaign kicked in because we didn't want to be seen as trying to, you know, guess the outcome of the race. So, I mean, I think a lot has changed since we pulled. I mean, we were in the field the first week of October, and since then you have, in effect, the various allegations against Ed Lee's campaign. You've had...
The folks who are purporting to help Ed Lee's
campaign.
Well, both. Campaign.
The allegations, I guess, for both, right? Significant momentum, including the Chronicle endorsement for Board President David Chu. I think, you know, John Avalos appeared on national news. In the meantime, I think you have the kerfuffle between the Newsom folks and Dennis Herrera over Mr. Herrera's role in the same-sex marriage.
And, of course, the all-important MC Hammer endorsement, which changes everything.
Dog Pack endorsed in the meantime, too. So we also have the dog endorsement and MC Hammer both. So
You made a point that there weren't any polls. I guarantee you that most of the viable campaigns have run polls. The reason we haven't seen them is there are some fundamental rules in politics. And one of them is when you run your poll, the smart political reporters are going to ask to see the crosstabs, and they're going to ask to see all of the data behind it. And if the poll doesn't tell the story that's best for your candidate, why, you're just not going to release it. And I would imagine that Mayor Lee's campaign has run several polls, and I would imagine they have shown that while his competitors are not gaining on him in an impressive fashion, they're also not showing that he's moving away from 30%. So that's not necessarily a good story. And if you're one of the folks who is attempting to unseat Mayor Lee and you're not pulling past 12%, you might not want to release that to Matera and Ross either, because they may just make fun of you.
And so how do you see this? How do you see this playing out tomorrow in terms of people being able to manipulate and understand the ranked choice voting system?
I like telling people who explain to me that they're very confused about this that they should channel their inner six-year-old and figure out what kind of ice cream they want. And here's how it works. You want chocolate ice cream. Okay, mark chocolate ice cream is number one. If you can't have chocolate ice cream, you want strawberry ice cream. Mark strawberry ice cream is number two. And if neither of those two are available, will you settle for butter pecan? If so, mark butter pecan three. That part's easy to understand. What happens at the Department of Elections, they've got, I'm sure, an Excel spreadsheet that is the master Excel spreadsheet in the universe that crunches all the numbers and figures out who wins. But from a voter's perspective, put who you want to win first, just like you always have. And then you have two backup choices in case your first choice doesn't win.
So it's actually a lot simpler, perhaps, than people are expecting. It's just the math, so to speak, of how it all gets sorted later that's more complicated, but that's not really...
I think the voting task is relatively simple, and we've done studies that look at rates of voter error and find that there are more errors in certain communities than others, and I think that's significant. So it is a more complicated voting task than just ranking one, but that in of itself isn't necessarily what confuses people. I think the things that confuse people are, for example, in this race we have 12, you know, really strong candidates. You can't just say, hey, I really don't like candidate X, and so as a result, I'm going to vote for all the competitors, because you can't list all the competitors. You can only rank three. And so this race is often compared to the race in Oakland, which, you know, Don Prado was leading on election night and ultimately lost the race. Well, part of the reason that happened is because, you know, in effect, there were really only three people running against him. And so those who didn't like Don Prada could just rank the other three major candidates. In a race like this, part of the challenge for voters is if they don't want their vote to be discontinued, they've got to have a guess of, you know, who to put third strategically, because it's not simply enough to say, hey, you like your top three choices.
You have to think of who's has a chance of winning.
You have to think of who has a chance of winning. And I think that adds a little bit of complexity to voters. And the other thing that is complex to voters is, in my view, if voters don't understand fully how the tallying works, they don't even know the mechanics or the algorithm behind it, or that, frankly, I think the nuclear launch codes are probably simpler to get from the Department of Elections than this.
I've got them in my briefcase.
Voters have to know that there's enough legitimacy attached to the results that whoever wins, they say they won because they were preferred on election day, not because of the ranked choice algorithm. And I think one of the things that's come up in some of the races where you have had somebody who wasn't in first place and they won was that voters have said, how did they game the system? How did ranked choice voting result in this? As opposed to, which is true in every case, the person who won was preferred by voters, and they won because they actually were preferred, not because of this voting system.
Mm-hmm. Corey, on election day in Oakland last year, I think I've heard you say Jean Kwan was on more ballots.
She was on 62% of the ballots, and Don Prada was on 54% of the ballots. Now, he was ranked first 9% of the time more than she was. So he had a 9-point lead when they cast first place votes. But he was uniquely polarizing, and she beat him head to head. That's why she's mayor.
And right now, do you think Don Prada is looking out and saying, wow, glad that turned out the way it turned out? I don't want that problem of Occupy Oakland in my backyard.
And there are probably some other Oaklanders who wish it turned out differently.
So you know that Eric from San Francisco posts on our Facebook page. He says, I've narrowed it down to three, but I don't know how to rank them. And I think this is the issue you talked about a little bit earlier, Corey,
huge.
Is that they're so similar that how do you order that?
Right.
Yeah. So let's actually go to a call. 415-841-4134, feedback@cityvisionsradio.com, or our Facebook page, which is City Visions. So let's go to Corey from San Francisco.
All right.
Welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Yes.
I have a question about the effectiveness of whoever is going to be mayor, whoever wins. It seems there's been a lot of mudslinging, and I'm wondering how you guys think that's going to affect the administration's ability to, you know, bring about, you know, all the stuff that they talk about during the campaign with, you know, so many people whom are vying for that position are working, you know, for the city right now. How does that affect the effectiveness of the next mayor's administration?
Okay, thanks so much for your call, Corey. Yes, Alex.
You've hit upon the primary difference between campaigning and governing. When you campaign, as all 12 of the candidates Corey is talking about are the leading candidates, all 16 if you want to throw in our friend Caesar and a couple other folks, you set out your priorities. You talk about what it is you want to do. And after you win, if you are lucky or unlucky, as the case may be, enough to win, you are forced and faced with the situation of actually implementing what it is you said you would do. San Francisco is not a uniquely complex city to run, but it certainly has a set of challenges that you don't find in, say, Palo Alto. You don't find in Fresno. You have an incredibly involved populace. You have an enormous number of active and engaged and powerful citizen groups. You have a strong bench of people, all of whom want your job and aren't shy about explaining that they're coming to get it. And you have a continuing budget crisis that I think is entering into it's sort of like cats. We're 17 years in and it's not going away. We have a structural budget deficit that a couple of the propositions on the ballot seek to start to remedy. And it's important to note when we get to our pension discussion that neither Prop C nor Prop D actually fixes the situation we're in. Mm-hmm. San Francisco is a place with enormous possibility and an enormous number of problems for anybody who sets out to make San Francisco the gleaming city on a hill that they all say it can be.
And political power, just to add to that, political power is also diffused throughout the system. And so while it's a stronger mayor system, having a city administrator, having a powerful board of supervisors who are independently elected, I think whoever wins this race is going to have some fence mending to do with the other candidates. I mean, it's if the front runner, Ed Lee, ends up winning, you know, he's been, I guess, jousting with the president
of
the supervisors and his lawyer, the city attorney. So I think, you know, I think there's going to be some challenges. I think one of the other things that comes up, when we're sort of joking a couple times about Oakland, is that it's likely that whoever wins this race isn't going to get a majority of the vote.
Certainly not in the first round.
Certainly not in the first round, and likely probably not at all, because there'll be a high number of discontinued ballots, or what are called exhausted ballots, which, you know, the person who's posted on Facebook, if those three choices aren't one of the final three, that ballot will ultimately go into this exhausted ballots column and not be determinative of the outcome of the election. There are exhausted ballots in every election, so this isn't a criticism of ranked choice voting, but what it is to say is that if somebody doesn't win a majority in the election, they're then assembling a governing coalition while in office. So the mandate that is often you get out of an election is a little bit minimized, and that can cause governing problems. Again, this is largely what Gene Kwan has faced with in Oakland is, if voters have not seen you with a significant mandate after the election and political power is diffused, then you have to spend the early part of your administration trying to actually build that majority that you hope to build during the election. And I think that's likely to be a challenge regardless of who wins this election.
415-841-4134, as we talk about tomorrow's election here on City Visions on Local Public Radio, KLW San Francisco. I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight we have our guests here, Corey Cook, Assistant Professor of Politics at the University of San Francisco and Director of the University's Leo T. McCarthy Center for Public Service and the Common Good, and Alex Clemens, a political strategist and founder of Barbary Coast Consulting, a San Francisco-based public affairs firm, and he's also a lecturer affiliated with the University of San Francisco's McCarthy Center.
That's the more important line, by the way.
I know. 415-841-4134. I should put that one first.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. We're very proud to have Alex.
Second.
I can't tell you.
that was a ranked choice winning joke there. 415-841-4134. Feedback at cityvisionsradio.com or our Facebook page. You just type in City Visions in the search bar and you can find us there. let's round out the discussion for now about the mayoral election. How close do you think it's going to be, and how many rounds do you think this is going to go?
Wow, it's time to pull out the crystal ball. I don't have a sense of that. I think that we're going to see tomorrow the head of the Department of Elections show up around 8:30, 8:45, and make a presentation of all of the ballots that have come in by mail. And that's absolutely not determinative. They've got to get all the ballots in before they can start figuring out who's in last place and how to redistribute those ballots, and then who's in last place and how to redistribute those ballots. I don't know how long it's going to take a candidate to get over 50%. I'm guessing it's on the order of, well, if there are 16 candidates, I think you're going to have three or four left at the tail end, perhaps only two, but my sense is it's going to be three left.
Corey?
I'm great at predicting elections. I think President Gore, President Kerry, and Mayor Parada would tell you what a good job I do of predicting these things.
He's also said I'm going to be in the next astronaut program, so I'm very excited about that.
I actually failed to predict the Parada election after the election, which I think is uniquely qualifies me for talking about this one. I think there are really two possible scenarios, and so here's my dodge, is that I think, you know, as we look at other ranked choice elections, there's two possible outcomes. One is that the front runner is comfortably ahead, and then we'll know pretty soon on election night that that's likely the case, and that the ranked choice voting will take place, and the first results will be on Wednesday, and we'll know roughly how it'll go. The other scenario is that I think Dennis Herrera and John Avalos have a lot of momentum behind them. And I think the other scenario is that you see a tightening with those three candidates, and then it comes down to whether Avalos and Herrera are in each other's first and second choices. And so I think on election night, again, it's hard to say how exactly it'll turn out, but I think those are sort of, at this point to me, the two likely scenarios. Mm-hmm. Is in essence a progressive voting bloc in favor of those two candidates, or Mayor Lee maintaining his advantage that we saw a month or so ago.
And how is the current economic crisis, the Occupy SF, Occupy Wall Street crisis, going to affect tomorrow's vote? Is that going to mean more people are going to come out, perhaps? Is it going to affect what kinds of change versus stability people are looking for when they vote for mayor? Any thoughts on that, Alex?
Yeah, the Occupy movement is an interesting national movement. It's not Occupy SF. It's Occupy. It's going on all over the country. Some places slightly better than others. Who would have thought that Occupy Philadelphia would be completely peaceful, whereas Occupy Oakland has tear gas flying through the air? I think that it's going to be one of the factors, but probably the sixth or eighth or tenth factor in people's minds as they vote. I think whether or not you've got a job, whether or not your cousin who's sleeping on your couch is unemployed, and that's why he's sleeping on your couch 6 months in, those those economic issues are going to be more important than what's going on with the protests. I think where Occupy is going to matter is if it survives through the winter, and these folks are still camped out around the country in March and April and May of next year, every member of Congress is up for re-election, and we have a president who is going to be running to keep his office. That is where Occupy is going to matter. You are going to see people across the country running for Congress as outsiders, and you could have a 1974 insurgent class of anti-Wall Street folks attempting to win office. I don't think, however, it's going to be the issue for the San Francisco mayor's race.
Yeah, I agree with Alex. I think the way this stuff plays in effect is in terms of the framing of the race. And so if you look at the positions candidates take, I think this is certainly a campaign that's been argued around, you know, job creation, fiscal responsibility, which are not necessarily the traditional issues in a San Francisco election. So I think those things come up in terms of the roles they play, in terms of what issues come out, or in terms of the ballot measures. But I agree with Alex that I don't think the, you know, barring a late night clearing of Occupy SF and the style of what happened in Oakland, I don't think those things will necessarily play a role in this election.
And the other part is, would it pull in other voters that maybe wouldn't be aligning themselves with the Occupy movement to say, you know, we need to have our voices heard here because we're worried about what's going on in Justin Herman Plaza or across the bay in Oakland. I mean, will it pull people to the polls that wouldn't normally vote, will it swing their vote in a more conservative slant? Any thoughts there?
The people who are opposed to Occupy SF and don't like the dirty hippies on their lawn, they vote already. They vote in nearly 100% of the elections. It will be interesting to see whether Occupy SF marches down to City Hall and demands to vote tomorrow. I think that's a possibility. I think they're well organized enough to do that. I have no idea if that's already happening. But if they do, I would imagine that Supervisor Avalos will be leading the parade. And that might be helpful to him in a complex, crowded race with 16 candidates where people are attempting to break out of double digits and unseat an incumbent with a strong lead.
And Ed Lee's, the concerns about him going back on his word, this question around voter tampering, both within his campaign and those supporting him. Any thoughts that that's going to unseat his lead?
You know, I think the controversy over whether he went back on his word is largely not at all interesting to voters. I mean, they're used to candidates saying that they don't plan to run for office and then do. Actually, you know, President Obama was one of those who said he wasn't running for president and did. I think that's actually more of a problem when it comes to governing than it is to the election. I don't think it's a one-off for voters to say, well, actually, it turns out that he now has a troubled relationship with the president of the Board of Supervisors, and it may not be as rosy once he's elected than it was in this interim period. It's a little far for voters to make that leap and then say, and according to that, then I should make a different choice in my vote. That's not really how voters approach these things. Largely, it turns out that voters, their frame of who they like already comes first. And so voters say, hey, I like this Ed Lee. I think he's doing a good job. I'm glad he changed his mind. Good for him. And voters who don't like him say, I knew there was a reason why I didn't like him, and it's because he changes his mind. But they weren't going to vote for him anyway. I do think that the various allegations that were made against those supporting Ed Lee, the vote tampering allegations in Chinatown, the various campaign finance allegations are serious ones, and they're significant. But they are, in fact, independent of his campaign. I think, to me, one of the challenges that we have in elections generally is we have this, what I would regard as a scandalous system of campaign financing, where we tightly regulate what a campaign can do and then not regulate at all what can go on independent committees. So independent committees did both make this incredible MC Hammer ad, which was a great, great ad, independent committee, and they also do things like hold stencils and tell people how they, you know, can help them vote in Chinatown. Neither of those things can you then say to the candidate, I'll hold you responsible for what just happened, because it's independent of the campaign.
And in the immutable rules of politics, one of them is, if you're not winning, change the narrative. And if you are winning, keep everything exactly the same. And I know a few of the people in each of the campaigns. And I know there are folks in the Ed Lee headquarters who are sitting there starting every sentence with friends like these.
Oh, absolutely! Yeah, absolutely. This was the real damage done to his campaign was by his supporters, not by the challengers in the race.
Right, and just to make sure our listeners understand this issue of what is campaign public financing? How does it restrict what a campaign can do? But then there's this sort of, is it loopholes, the right way to call it, bypass tract called the independent expenditure committees, where a lot of things can happen that are not subject to as much as tight a control. Is that
Is that right? Sketch that out for us.
Essentially, the Supreme Court for the last nearly 40 years has distinguished between direct speech and indirect speech. And indirect speech is money that you give to a campaign, to a candidate, and that they use to run their own campaign. And the Supreme Court has held that that can be regulated. In San Francisco, we regulate that with $500 contribution limits and a series of other regulations on what can be raised and spent. And we do the public financing, which says you agree to cap how much you'll spend in exchange for public monies.
And it can only be from individuals, not corporations.
Exactly. And on the other side, if it's money that you spend on your own as independently as an individual or as a committee, it can't be regulated. It's a direct speech. And this court has held and has increased actually the protections for direct speech. And as a result, what you have is a sort of two-track system.
And that's the Citizens United ruling?
Well, it started with Buckley versus Vallejo in the 1970s and then reaffirmed with Citizens United and then the Supreme Court decision in Arizona this year. So it's the court's been pretty consistent in saying that there's a direct speech that it's not regulated. What they started doing with Citizens United is say that, for example, corporations can now play politics too in indirect speech and not just have these committees that are not affiliated in essence with the corporation. So go ahead.
A broad example of this is, Joseph, if you look at Corey and you think he'd be a great candidate for mayor, you can give Corey $500. You can write him a check for $500, and he can use that to hire campaign staff, buy ads, print mailers. Now, if you really, really, really think Corey should be mayor, after you write him the $500 check, you can write me a $1 million check, because I don't talk to Corey, and I'm not talking to Corey's campaign people, and as long as I don't coordinate with Corey, I can write an ad saying Corey Cook is the best thing since sliced bread and all of his opponents are evil hippies.
Or better yet, you can get MC Hammer to do it.
415-841-4134. Email us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. And you can check us out on our Facebook page. So let's go to Letta. Welcome to the program.
Hello. Hi. I'm a San Francisco resident, and I'm wondering which candidates are strong on animal welfare. I'm particularly concerned about the two contracts that were given to this guy from Brooklyn, Otterness, who shot a dog. And they're worth $1.5 million the San Francisco Arts Commission gave him two contracts. So I'm wondering which candidates would be most likely to put a stop to this.
Okay, thanks so much, Letta, for your call. Alex?
I think... I'm passingly conversant with the second issue. A gentleman won a contract to do a piece of public art in San Francisco, and it turns out that early on in his career in New York, 20, 30 years ago, he did a performance art video piece where he shot a dog to death on video. My understanding is that the art piece has been put on ice, perhaps canceled. I think we don't have to worry about that one raising its head at any point soon. In terms of which candidate is going to be best on issues related to animal welfare, I can't answer that question. I know it's of import to a lot of people, but Corey, do you happen to remember who got the dog pack endorsement?
Avalos got the dog pack endorsement. I believe Herrera was second for the dog pack endorsement.
So if you're a dog and you have an interest group of other dogs, I think this is the dog companions or the dog owners, they recently voted to endorse those two gentlemen. I think you're probably going to be hard-pressed to find somebody in San Francisco politics who is going to come out with an anti-animal rights statement of any sort. It's nearly inconceivable.
Okay, great. 415-841-4134, feedback@cityvisionsradio.com, or our Facebook page, City Visions. And let's go next to Carnella.
Yeah,
Carnella, sorry, from San Francisco. Welcome to the program.
Well, hey, Joseph.
Hi.
Alex and Corey. I'm so glad you guys are doing this because I was sitting at my desk not an hour ago, and my colleagues and I were like, what do we do for tomorrow? We're so stupid. I mean, it's like I loved hearing Alex's chocolate ice cream analogy. But call me crazy, Alex, but I still kind of like worry and want to ask you guys this question. What happens to my number one vote and I think there's a likely possibility that we go down to the second ranking.
If your number one vote is trailing,
yeah.
Your number two vote, if your number one vote is trailing and is then eliminated by the very complicated Excel spreadsheet, it will check to see who your number two vote is. And your number two vote acts just like a number one vote for that candidate. until that candidate is eliminated, at which point your number three vote is checked out, and that act, all of the votes are worth exactly the same.
They are.
Now, if
it just
you,
depends on when they count.
Right. If you want to be practical about this,
yes,
go with the chocolate, vanilla, butter pecan, or whatever flavors. And I'm not an advocate for only chocolate ice cream. I simply happen to prefer it myself. If you want to be super strategic about this.
Yes, I do.
Practical and super strategic. I like you. This is good. I want you to do two things.
Okay.
Rank the candidates in the order that you think you want them to become mayor.
Okay.
And once you've got that, plan to vote that way. But look at it with a harsh light of day and say, really, are any of these three people going to get elected? Because if you've got three fringe candidates who you love them, you think they're great, they petted your dog down at the dog park and they sent you a cool piece of mail, but you're doing your math and you're pretty sure they're going to get knocked out in early rounds?
Yeah.
Take somebody who is the least of your evils.
Yeah,
but you think, might
got
win.
Three of the top peeps.
If you got three of the top people, you are in no danger. But if you have three fringe candidates, consider taking your third vote and plugging in somebody who you would be willing to live with and who has a good shot at winning.
Yes.
And just to explain a little bit, so the way that the candidates are eliminated is they tally all the first place votes. And with the 16 candidates, the candidates that is in 16th place is the one eliminated. And those votes then become retallied for those voters' second place votes. So your vote will go from your first choice to your second choice when your first place choice is at some point in last and eliminated from the race.
Oh, that's what I've wanted to know.
Magic.
Oh, wow. I've got to call everybody now.
Yeah, so you don't have to worry about your second place vote hurting your first place vote getter. You only go to your second place vote when that person has been eliminated from the race.
And Carnella, do you want to share with us who your top three are?
All right.
Oh,
all right,
sure.
Carnella.
I will definitely. Okay, I'm not going to tell you in which order.
Oh. That's to be decided. Okay, go on.
Okay. Avalos. I'm getting all of a sudden skittish. The person who is now the city attorney.
Dennis Herrera.
And I'm don't know for sure.
See, this is critical because then we can determine whether you're voting the Bay Guardian slate or the Dog Pack slate.
The third one's
critical.
I've not read any slate whatsoever. They're useless.
If you tell us who you're voting for, we can probably predict the results of tomorrow's election. This is essential.
But I think it's important. I think, Carnella, the point that was made earlier in the program is that you need to exercise all three of your options, right?
Yeah.
Because once you've exhausted it, then your ballot gets tossed.
Correct.
You get lost. Yeah, so if you only do one, then you're done.
If that person's out, exactly right.
Right.
Wow, guys.
Well, thanks, Carnella.
Thank you.
Okay.
I think we saved lives here today, Corey.
415-841.
University of San Francisco, saving lives one ballot at a time.
415.
New tagline. I like it.
415-841-4134. That's why we bring you back every year. 415-841-4134. feedback@cityvisionsradio.com, or you can go and comment on our Facebook page, City Visions. This is City Visions on Local Public Radio 91.7 KLW San Francisco and on the web at kalw.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight we're discussing tomorrow's elections with our guests Corey Cook of the University of San Francisco and Alex Clemens with Barbary Coast Consulting and the University of San Francisco. Again, 415-841-4134 or feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. So here's an email from John from San Francisco who says, can you put the same person in all three slots?
Yes.
But
your ballot's going to be only counted for the first one.
Okay. So
The Department of Elections reserves the right to chuck out that ballot because it's not following their rules.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're thinking about it enough to listen into a radio show the night before and get educated about it, don't list the same person in all three. If you only want to vote for one person, go ahead and vote for them in first place.
But, yeah, the city's been generous in how they count the ballots. And so if you do that and you list the same person three times, they treat it as if you just voted for the first person, and they don't invalidate it. But it doesn't go on to a second choice, obviously.
And somewhere down at the Department of Elections, they may point at your ballot and snicker at you.
So let's actually shift gears for a moment and talk about a couple of bond measures. So the pension reform measures are ones that you talked about, Alex, in the beginning of the program. Do you want to just sketch out, those are C and D. Do you want to sketch out for the listeners kind of the big differences between those two?
I'd love to, and I'm afraid that we only have 20 minutes left, so that's going to require...
And every radio in San Francisco will shut off immediately.
I think as soon as you said the word bond, a third of our audience went away. Basically, you have two competing visions as to how to address the city's structural, enormous pension tsunami that is just over the horizon. I'm a former city employee, and I remember when I went in to sign my papers to work for the city and county of San Francisco, I was signing each piece of paper, and there was one page that said, basically, as I recall, when you hit 50 years old, if you've worked for the city for only 5 years, you will be able to purchase health insurance from the city at the exact same rate that everybody working for the city is purchasing it. And I thought to myself, uneducated 22-year-old, this looks ridiculously stupid. How are we afloat? And I said this to the nice lady across the table, and she was like, look, it's a good deal. Go ahead and sign it. I signed it. Every city employee has got a tremendous package of solid... This is San Francisco. We care about the health and welfare of our citizenry, and the people who work for the city are well taken care of. And we've discovered in recent years they may be perhaps too well taken care of. Proposition C is what the mayor and the board of supervisors and a variety of other folks all pretty unanimously came together, and I should say came together before Mayor Lee said he was running for mayor, and said this is our first step to addressing how we are going to stop the pension tsunami. And what the pension tsunami is eventually we're going to be giving out more money to our retirees through health and direct monetary benefits than we're taking in as a city, and that's not sustainable. Proposition D is put on the ballot and is slightly stronger in how it addresses the upcoming damage that's going to be done to the city, but it was not done in a collaborative way. It was done by one mayoral candidate who happens to be the public defender of San Francisco, Jeff Adachi, who deserves credit last year for putting last year's failed pension reform ballot measure on the ballot and championing this and getting it into the main of San Francisco's political conversation. This is one of the toughest things to learn about. Prop C and Prop D both may be challenged in court. Prop C's backers say, well, ours was collaborative and fully vetted by attorneys, and it's going to pass muster with the courts, and Prop D is going to go down in flames. And Prop D's supporters say exactly the same thing, but, you know, reversed.
And theirs supposedly saves more money, Prop D.
Yes, and it's important to point out that neither of these two measures fully addresses the gap between what's coming in and what's going out. Both of them ameliorate the gap, but there's more work yet to be done.
And in the light of the Occupy movement, though, and what happened in other states around, you know, a collective bargaining being stripped from public employees, how do you think San Francisco voters are going to go to the polls with this one? Are they looking at, we're going to try to get at this perception that public employees are too well compensated, or are they going to say this is trying to balance the budget on the backs of public workers?
Right.
Corey?
Well, you know, I think this is a great question. You know, the real advantage that the backers of Prop C have is that they negotiated with labor from the outset, and labor's endorsed Prop C. And so I don't think that argument's necessarily being made to the electorate in a consistent way. So, you know, I guess these measures are very mild in comparison to what you saw in Wisconsin, certainly. And they're frankly very mild compared to what Governor Brown just rolled out a couple of weeks ago.
And they're mild compared to last year's.
And they're mild compared to Prop B last time. So I think, you know, on the one hand, you know, I certainly have problems with sort of demonizing public employees as we've seen in other states. I think, you know, because these were, you know, were designed the way they were, they don't solve the problem. I mean, this is. You know, they barely scratch the surface of the problem. At the same time, because they were collaboratively done with, particularly C, done with labor's participation, I don't think it has, you know, the same connotations, the same arguments haven't been made about it as you've seen in other states.
Is this the situation of we have our chance here, we don't know when this collaborative spirit will come around again, and we...
Well, to be frank, I think labor realizes how bad the situation is politically for it.
They can participate in the solution, or they can have the solution imposed upon them.
Yeah, exactly.
And so let's go to an email regarding this from Denise in San Francisco. She says, Measure C and D are both backed by billionaires. Measure C is also backed by the Chamber of Commerce. Now, don't they represent the 1% we are rallying against? Measure C will also cause health care costs for families and retirees to rise above what most families or retirees can afford. It has little effect on the highest paid managers and administrators or police and the fire personnel, the very ones who are taking the most out of the city coffers. $1.47 billion is spent on top manager salaries alone. Any thoughts on those comments?
I think she should have been on this radio show rather than me and Corey. She seems to be extraordinarily well informed. I think the thing it points out is what you just heard is certainly a set of true facts that exist. And there are another set of true facts that exist that perhaps contradict some of those things. The one constant in San Francisco politics is demonizing billionaires never goes out of style.
Right. 415-841-4134 or Facebook, our Facebook page, which is City Visions, or feedback at cityvisionsradio.com. And let's go next to Harry from San Francisco. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Thank you for taking my call. I'm not a fan of Occupy FM, and I understand that a certain number of the mayoral candidates went down a couple of evenings ago when there was a rumor that there was going to be a bust up of the occupation, and by their presence attempted to suggest or prevent that any police action should take place. So I'm not in favor of those candidates who participated in the action. And I wonder if you can identify those who came down so that I can be sure I don't cast my vote in favor.
I'm sorry, say one more time.
I wonder if you can identify those mayoral candidates who went down to the Occupy SF site in an act of solidarity with those who were participating. Because I'm not a fan of Occupy SF, and I want to make sure that I don't cast my vote in favor of those candidates.
Okay, thanks so much for your call. You were just breaking up there. I want to make sure we got the right question. Okay, Alex?
This is going to be anecdotal and probably not complete. I do know that several members of the San Francisco Board of Supervisors, some mayoral candidates and some not, went to Occupy SF. I believe they include Supervisors David Campos and Jane Kim. I believe Supervisor John Avalos has made no secret of the fact that he is standing in solidarity with Occupy SF. I believe State Senator Leland Yee has been to Occupy SF several times. Corey, do you know of others who've been?
That's my list, I think.
Joanna Reese showed up there on day two,
I believe.
That right? Yeah. Day two. It was still just, it wasn't right. Even being covered
day
by the news. But I am certain Joanna Reese went, and I believe she brought a muffin basket.
Okay. 415-841-4134 or feedback at cityvisionsradio.com. Let's go to a couple of the other races because we're running.
Back at muffin basket.
I know.
I'm sorry.
I'm moving us along. because we want to make sure to cover the other ones. So let's talk about the district attorney election. And here, George Gascon has a sizable lead. Is there a race still going on here?
Yeah, I think there's a really interesting race going on. We polled this a month ago. I mean, about half the voters were undecided on their first choice. And I think when you started asking people second and third, they said, huh? So I think there's a significant race going on here. My sense is that most people think that Mr. Gascon still has a lead in the race, but there are, you know, four other candidates who are serious and certainly qualified. And I think this is one of the ones that I think, you know, the sort of insiders will be watching on election night.
Just to run through them, George Gascon was the city's police chief, and as Mayor Newsom left to go to Sacramento, he tapped him to serve as district attorney. And as far as anyone knows, this is the first time in American history that a big city police chief has moved over to the DA's office, probably because most big city police chiefs don't have the law degree necessary for it. Also in the race, the gentleman who's been running the longest is David Onick, who comes from academia and a criminal justice background. He is, not incidentally, Michael Dukakis' son-in-law. You have Charmaine Bach, who is an Alameda County prosecutor, though she lives in San Francisco, thereby making herself eligible to run for this office. The only woman in the race, she's touting herself as the only person with direct courtroom experience. You have Bill Fazio, who has run for district attorney 7,926 times before. I think actually only three, but it seems sort of a similar number, who is a criminal defense attorney who used to be a deputy DA, and you have a gentleman, Trinh Vu, am I pronouncing that correctly? And I don't think a lot of folks, he's not in the main of the public discussion about the DA's race.
And how do you think the voters are going to try to sort out the difference between Onik, Bach, and Fazio at this point?
I think that there's going to be an immediate filter on gender. I think that there is going to be an immediate filter on whether or not Gavin Newsom and Ed Lee are thought of positively in your household or negatively in your household, which affects George Gascon. And I think those are the primary filters people are going to use. I think it's important to note that the DA's race, given who's running for it, is perhaps the third most watched race in San Francisco in the sheriff's race, which I'm sure we're going to get to in a moment.
Let's go there right now.
Sitting city supervisor, Ross Mercurini, who leapt into the race the moment Sheriff Hennessy decided that he was not running for re-election and has been endorsed by Sheriff Hennessy. You have Chris Cunney, who is a long-standing gentleman involved in the police department, criminal justice activities, and nonprofits in San Francisco. You've got Paul Miyamoto, who is do you know his rank?
He was a deputy.
Sheriff's captain.
Captain in the sheriff's department and has the near unanimous support of his fellow deputy sheriffs. This is a hard-fought race. There are a couple other people in the race as well who have not made a dent in the polls, as far as I can tell.
Yeah, our poll just was noise on this, frankly. And this, again, it was a month ago, but it was just a lot of huge undecideds.
So these two races are being nearly drowned out by all of the hoopla over the mayor's race. And, you know, frankly, it's important to have a good DA. It's important to have the sheriff's office administered well. But neither of those offices, unless you're a habitual criminal, factor into most San Franciscans' lives on a day-to-day basis. But what the mayor does in terms of setting the tone, working with the Board of Supervisors, creating a budget that sets out priorities for the city, that's something that everybody gets. And combine it with the noise about ranked choice voting, the noise about public financing, and all of the excitement with Occupy SF, there's not a whole lot of time for folks to get deep into the DA's race and the sheriff's race unless they're political junkies.
And I think that means the name recognition will be critical. So I think, you know, most people think the DA's race, that, you know, obviously by far former Chief Gascon has the highest name recognition. That would probably play to his favor. I would say just, you know, speculatively, I know a lot of folks are interested in the sheriff's race and the possibility of a ranked choice voting outcome in that race where your second, third choices could really make a difference in that election. There is some sense of Mr. Miyamoto and Chris Cunney sort of splitting each other's first and second place votes. And so if it turns out that Supervisor Mercurimi is ahead on first place votes, it's certainly conceivable that you would have somebody who wasn't in first place on the first place tally end up winning because of ranked choice voting.
Sort of an Oakland redux. Corey, I've got a question for you about ranked choice voting. I've heard anecdote. You're an academic, and I'm not, even though I sometimes come up to USF and pretend to know things. The offhand math I had heard was that in all the places ranked choice voting has worked or has been run over the years, rule of thumb is 95% of the time, whoever's in first place at the end of the first ballot count wins. In 4% of the time, whoever's in second place wins. And in 1% of the cases, it's somebody else. And that seems to feel approximately right. Last year, we had three outliers. We had District 2 and 10 in San Francisco, and we had Oakland.
And we had the San Leandro mayoral. There are four outliers. So there have been 54 RCV contests in the Bay Area, and four of them were won by somebody who was on a first-place vote-getter.
And they all happened.
And they were all in 2010.
Year. But here's a question. As people tomorrow night are going to be watching the news at 8 or 9 o'clock at night, and the director of elections is going to come out and say, here are the numbers as we know them right now. Is there a number that is academically defensible to say, okay, candidate A has, in the mayor's race, 33% of the vote, and candidate B, their closest competitor, is behind by, is there a percentage at which we can say, we're done? Or has that been ruined by your experience last year with the Oakland mayor's race?
Yeah, I'm sure there's that number, and I'm the last one to give it, because I gave it last year, and it turns out it was wrong. Up until the Parada race, the outer limit we thought was about 6%. That was about what a candidate come back. And there are a zillion reasons I can explain what happened in Oakland and why it was unique and why it's unlikely to be repeated in any of these races. You know, for me, the mayoral election, 5 or 6 points. For a race like the sheriff's race, where there are fewer candidates and there's more likely to be cohesion between several candidates, it's probably closer to 8 or 9%, as we saw in Oakland. There's still going to be a high number of discontinued ballots, people who don't rank all three choices where their vote's discontinued, or, you know, people who, you know, just had the bullet vote. They like the one person, they don't care. It's the only person they liked, or they didn't know they could rank three. Whatever reason, they only rank one and it doesn't continue on. There are a lot of votes that end up not continuing. So, you know, the rule of thumb is about 5 or 6 percentage points generally. Again, in a race like Parada's, which is unique, you know, it turned out to be closer to 10 or 11%.
So we have a few minutes left, and I just want to run through a couple of other propositions. So Proposition G, which would increase the sales tax by 0.5%. Thoughts on where that's going to go?
We're running out of time. So before we talk about this one specifically, I would like to encourage people to look at what I believe is the best voter guide in San Francisco. It's nonpartisan. It is fully analytical. It's run not by a political organization, but by an urban research association. If you go to spur.org and download their voter guide, I would suggest you're going to get the most information you possibly can from any source in San Francisco without being, compelled or urged to vote one way or another. They do have recommendations on many of the ballot measures, but they show all of the pros and all of the cons. It's one of the fairest laying out of the ballot measures I've ever seen. And as far as the sales tax is concerned, I don't know. In this economic time, I am not sure that folks are going to want to tax themselves. Corey, have you seen any poll data on this?
I've not seen polling data, but sales taxes have not done well in San Francisco. People don't like tax increases generally, and a sales tax is a regressive tax increase. So when it's been on the ballot in the past, it's had sort of a left-right coalition against it because on the one hand, it's a tax increase. On the other hand, it's a regressive one.
Let's go to Proposition F, which is... modifies the way that campaign consultants disclose how much they've earned or when they have to disclose how much they've earned and how frequently. Any thoughts here in this, as we've been talking tonight about how campaign finance reform isn't all it's cracked up to be necessarily? How does this one look?
This is not going to reform how campaign finance works. It's going to make sure that almost everybody who works on a campaign, no matter how low level they are, if they get a check for $1,000 or more in the aggregate over a certain period of time, they are a campaign consultant, according to Prop F. As it stands now, you need to get $5,000 in compensation over a period of time. So that's the primary change here. It doesn't change the underlying system. It simply makes a lot more political junkies go register down at City Hall that they are in fact working on campaigns.
Let's do Prop E, which is the initiative amendment reform, which would allow the Board of Supervisors and the mayor to tinker with the ballot measures that were passed by voters but placed on the ballot by the Board of Supervisors and the mayor. Some people are saying this is a great idea. It helps us to kind of reduce the amount of tinkering with ballot measures by having to go back to the voters all the time. Other people think it's not particularly as clear cut as that. Corey.
Well, I think the two arguments are that once voters enact something, it ought to be sacrosanct and not messed with by the Board of Supervisors. And the other folks would say the counter argument is, you know, you make errors in drafting or situations change, you want to amend something, that these things, you're probably a third of what's on the ballot every time, I would guess. Or again, a rough estimate are things that are largely technical changes that probably didn't need to be on the ballot. And so it's presented both as it's an effort to sort of shorten the ballot as well as return some power to the elected representatives to change policy.
All right, and that's where we're going to have to stop it for tonight. We could have kept going. I want to thank our guest, Corey Cook, Assistant Professor of Politics at the University of San Francisco and Director of the Leo T. McCarthy Center for Public Service and the Common Good at USF, and Alex Clemens, Barbaricos Consulting, and also a lecturer at USF. For a link to this and other City Vision shows, to tell us know what you thought about tonight's programs, to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, check out our website at cityvisionsradio.com. Our engineer this evening was Eric Wayne. Tonight's show was produced by Susie Britton. Judith Sansone is our senior producer, and Neil Freese manages our website. I'll be away for a few weeks. Join my co-host Lauren Meltzer next Monday when we take a look at the Occupy movement and ask, is the message getting through? This is Joseph Pache. Thanks for listening. Good night and have a great week, and good luck with ranked choice voting.